Well, I think the big news that has been recently, certainly over the last day or so, has been the death of Mr. Yasser Arafat. As I mentioned to you before, Mr. Armstrong did in fact have an invitation to meet Mr. Arafat, and he declined. He wouldn't do so. When you read some of the background to that man, then you'll start to understand a little bit more about why Mr. Armstrong declined. He was a terrorist, there's no question of that, and he continued to, there's various articles that have appeared, and he certainly continued to, I think as he put it, he said he had an olive branch in one hand and a gun in the other, and he says, "Don't force me to put down the olive branch," and that was his kind of modus operandi. But it's interesting that when you do see what the papers are reporting, yesterday's paper, where it says, right in the very front page, it says, "Arafat brings hope in death." And then it goes on, it says, "French homage to the Palestinian leader." It says, "Yasser Arafat's body arrived in Egypt last night as cautious hopes were expressed that his death could give new life to Middle East peace moves. After a lavish farewell ceremony in Paris that seemed to accord the Palestinian leader the standing of a venerable head of state, a French military aircraft flew his coffin to Cairo, where he was born 75 years ago, where the funeral will be held today. The French government lavished pomp and praise on Mr. Arafat, who died early yesterday. It was clearly seeking to stand apart in the eyes of the Arab world from the Americans, who refused to deal with Mr. Arafat." Now that again is very significant, that here is Europe behaving towards this man in a very different way to the Americans and certainly the Israelis as well. Says, "President Jacques Chirac praised him as a man of conviction and courage, and during a visit to the hospital where he died, said, 'I come to bow before President Yasser Arafat and to pay him a final homage.'" When you see that, and then you also start to contrast it with what in fact was in Palestine when the body was finally arrived in Palestine, this is today's paper, and it says, "Scenes of chaos as Arafat is buried." You probably saw them, the pictures on the news last night, but it says, "It was all very different from the pomp of the earlier stages of Mr. Arafat's homecoming. France and Egypt showed him the honor due to a head of state, although he died without achieving his aim of creating an independent Palestine. These obsequities seemed more like a funeral of a martyr of the uprising than of a dignified occasion the authorities had hoped for." In other words, the Mukata obsequities, sorry, seemed more like the funeral of a martyr, these scenes of all this great crowd that was around him. "Says the compound was meant to have been empty except for dignitaries, clerics and guards, but the crowds that flooded to the headquarters after Friday prayers pushed their way through the steel gates in the Mukata entrance and were soon pressing back the security line protecting the landing strip. Mr. Erekat, one of the elite now at the apex of the Palestinian establishment, admitted that he was not the sort of funeral that he'd been hoping for. But these are Mr. Arafat's people, and they are part of his legacy to the new leadership. Like it or not, the leadership are going to have to listen to them." So these, you know, here we see this almost statesman-like. They tried to give him statesman-like status. And yet when he gets back to the Palestine itself, we see almost chaos that erupts around the coffin. And it is interesting that on the news this morning, they were talking about the various leaders, and there's an article here about the various leaders that, you know, moderates and fanatics fill the void. This is in Friday's paper. And in Ramallah it says, "On the hillsides of this handsome middle-class town, apartment blocks and houses stand half-finished, victims of the stasis that set in with the launching of the Second Intifada 4 years ago. The walls adorned with images of warriors bearing grenade launchers. And yesterday you could see the real thing as young men dressed in black and with their heads wrapped in their checkered scarves marched up and down, members of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed elements of Mr. Arafat's Fatah. They swore revenge on Israel, which they blamed for poisoning their leader." So the talk is now of a poisoning that took place. He says they are renaming themselves the Martyr Yasser Arafat Brigades in his honour, and they announced in Gaza. So it doesn't bode well for the peace process when you have this kind of chaotic element that is there. It's interesting as well that when they talked about the various people, you know, Abbas was one of them, and the various dignitaries that were supposed to be leading Palestine afterwards, there's one particular gentleman who is called Alberghetti, I think his name is. Alberghetti. I'd never heard of him. If there was a free election, because there's all this talk that's going on, and certainly Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush have got together just literally in the last day or so, and Mr. Bush pledges to Mr. Blair on the Middle East, it says, "I will turn the vision of peace into reality." This is what the pledge is coming from Mr. Bush now. And if I can just, before I go back to Alberghetti, it says, George W. Bush promised Tony Blair yesterday that he would use his second four-year term to realize the vision of Israel and the Palestine as independent states living side by side in peace. Now, this is the front page of the Telegraph this morning. And it says, but he set tough conditions for his support, insisting that the elections to choose a successor to Yasser Arafat must result in a leadership committed to democracy and efforts to stamp out corruption and terrorism. So immediately they put conditions on the elections, and they're trying to stop anything that kind of sidetracks it into what the people really want. And this is what was brought out in this interview that I heard this morning. This Alberghetti, he's currently in an Israeli prison. If they had free elections and he stood in those free elections, the person being interviewed said there's almost no doubt that he would win. Now, he's a young man. The other ones that are being mentioned are all old men who were with Yasser Arafat, of his generation. But this particular Alberghetti, who, according to the interview that I heard this morning, would win. He's anything but moderate. He's a terrorist in an Israeli prison. Now, can you imagine what would happen if he did stand? And then what happens? Well, Yasser Arafat got the Nobel Peace Prize, who's a terrorist. Nelson Mandela got the Nobel Peace Prize, which was a terrorist. And where's it coming from? It's coming from the European side. And you see the European side regarding Yasser Arafat, and also the way in which Jacques Chirac dealt with him and praised him. And you see the pressure that's likely to come on Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair from other quarters in this regard. So it's an area that really is a powder keg that is just waiting. And the idea that this is an opens new doors for peace, yes, it could do, but the ideas of peace are not always shared. They're not the same as is coming out of America, and this is something that we all need to understand. In the Telegraph this morning as well, it said that the special bond has soured into an awkward and unrequited love. Talking about the interview, the actual press conference with Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush, it said there were smiles yesterday as President George Bush and Tony Blair paraded their friendship at the White House. The telling thing was none of the smiles were Mr. Blair's. It says U.S. officials offer a key to the mystery of the two-man's bond. It says they talk of a close working friendship based on shared security goals. It is the reason why they cooperate together is because of the security problem. And it says their friendship reflects Mr. Blair's discipline in ensuring that the best possible personal relations assist with reaching his geopolitical objectives, he said. So I thought that was also a very interesting comment. The reason why Mr. Blair is there is because of what he sees as his own geopolitical objectives. They do not really reflect what is in the mind of Mr. George Bush. And because of that, the reason why I say that is that he has his sights set on the European presidency. And again, these things are very significant. And here we see the Middle East, here we see this passing of Yasser Arafat. And at the same time, you know, you're looking at democracy. know, there's this idea of democracy and all this talk of democracy and how rulership by the people, for the people, and all this other kind of rhetoric. We've got to understand what kind of democracy there is in this world. I'd like to just read something from Wednesday's paper. It says, the Flemish party banned as racist by Belgium's High Court. It says, Belgium's most popular political party was banned as racist by the country's High Court yesterday, fueling concerns. Now, notice, it's the most popular political party in Belgium. It's been banned. And it says, fueling concerns that the judicial branch is being used to eliminate political enemies. Now, I've brought this out before. The Justice Department and the Constitution is being left deliberately vague to be decided by the European courts. And here we see yet another case of these courts making decisions that are having profound effects, and it's eliminating political enemies. The Vlaams Blok, Vlaams Blok, a Flemish independence party promising to abolish Belgium as a nation, now cannot receive funding of any kind. It will have to be disbanded. Says this is an attack on democracy and free speech. Our political opponents have changed the racial laws six times in a campaign to have us condemned. What they've done today is shocking, he said. So six times they've changed the racial laws specifically to get rid of this particular political party that is the most popular political party in Belgium. Now, we need to understand and not be fooled by the idea that democracy is such a wonderful idea, because it's not democratic. It's not the people who are deciding. When we're looking down in the Middle East and we see this push for democracy down in Palestine as these peaceful states, that's not what the Americans and the Europeans want, or the Europeans want. They want somebody who reflects their views, and they will manipulate in order to get that. And as I brought out, that if they have a free election, you've got Al-Baghirti, who would almost certainly win in an Israeli jail. And there is this conflict that is arising between America on one side and Europe on the other. It says, and this is again another reason why, when you look at Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush giving this press conference, you don't get the smiles from Mr. Blair. Another article here from, Saturday's paper, last weekend. It says, France, Spain and Germany launched a triple axis yesterday aimed at taking charge of EU foreign policy and limiting Tony Blair's influence in Europe. So here is what Mr. Blair is facing at home in Europe. Jacques Chirac, the French president and a harsh critic of the war in Iraq, brushed aside appeals for better transatlantic ties after George Bush's re-election triumph and instead called for a stronger EU to confront Washington. Warning of a more multipolar world than ever, he said America's assertive policies made it critical for Europe to pull closer together as a single power bloc. Now, this was in last week's paper. Europe today has more than ever the need and necessity to reinforce its unity. That is the goal of the Constitution. Notice what he said. That's the goal of the Constitution. That's why the Constitution exists. He said, attending at a summit of EU leaders in Brussels. It says, the three agreed to attend rallies to boost support of the EU Constitution in France and Spain, where referendums are going to be held. The document, which creates the EU Foreign Minister and Diplomatic Service, equips Europe with superpower institutions and is viewed as a means to counter the American domination. So that is that one. In that same paper, there's another article on page 17 where it says Blair backs Eurojustice and ending asylum veto. It says Tony Blair agreed yesterday to a number of far-reaching measures aimed at equipping the European Union with full justice machinery. Defying Tory critics, Mr. Blair also acceded to long-standing plans to abolish the national veto on asylum and immigration by next spring. It says separately, in the end of the article, it says civil liberties groups are alarmed by the creation of an internal security committee comprising Europol, Eurojust and a national police chiefs that appear to lack clear democratic oversight. They say it is the Justice Department that is making the laws. They are not governed by anything which is democratic. and yet they deliberately have to word the Constitution in a nebulous way, and then have to firm everything up through this Justice Department. And we've just seen what happens in Belgium. Tony Bunyan, the head of the Liberties Group State Watch, said growing EU power in the field of public order was deeply disturbing. He asked, what is this committee really for, and who does it answer to? And this again is a real problem. A real problem. Now, at the same time as all this is going on, and I'm going to have to really bring this to a close fairly soon, because the tape today from Mr. Armstrong is a little bit longer than normal. But at the same time as all this is going on between America, the Middle East problem, and Europe, there's another thing that is going on as well, and that is China. Now, there's an article here from last weekend's paper which said the Manchurian candidates for domination, and he brings out here about how the first Chinese to cross into Siberia and the Russian Far East, once mostly sparsely inhabited areas on Earth, since then hundreds of thousands of Chinese have followed the well-worn path north. Each year the pace is accelerating, and such is the influx that locals and some experts predict a seismic demographic shift. So the Far East and south of Russia is becoming more and more Chinese. In addition, what's happening within China itself, this particular article was given to me by Mrs. Munro, and it comes from the Gifts, it's a gifts magazine. It really is where you've got a small shop and you have various gifts, and you're selling and retailing the gifts. This is the magazine that you get. And the article is Big Trouble in Little China. Little China being the gift industry within China. And it says, as the world's energy crisis escalates, the fuel crisis in Asia, particularly China, is looming larger and larger and could have serious ramifications for the gift industry in the crucial run-up to Christmas and well into next year. Without enough power to power machines, many factories are already on a 3 to 4 day week, unable to guarantee that they can meet orders, especially where prices are being squeezed. And it says some gift suppliers therefore may be faced with shortages and a difficult dilemma which of their customers to supply. And it says China, in various places here, it says China's power crisis has been so severe and widespread, over 175,000 cuts have been estimated, that thousands of manufacturing units are having to live with a reality of power rationing. Now this is going on right now within China. There is the boom that is occurring in China is causing the amount of power that they have available just not to be sufficient. It says, although the government is apparently doing everything it can to accommodate overseas investors by imposing lower levels of cuts and rationing, such as alternate days rather than 4 days weeks, major companies such as electronic giant Sony and car manufacturer Volkswagen have already been forced to cut production. So these issues are having an effect within China. Now what China is then doing about it is what is very important. This is coming from MiddleEast.org, and it says China makes a big move into the Middle East. It's when you understand what's going on in China currently, then you put it together with this particular article, and you see the expansionist nature of China. You put it together with prophecy, which shows the position of China at the end time, and you see the players starting to emerge from the mess that there is currently. And we should wake up and realize what's going on. It says MiddleEast.org, Washington, 10th of November. As the Americans expend their power, their money, their blood, and their credibility, the miserable siege of Fallujah in Iraq is but the latest examples, both Europe and China are on the march. Europe is more often discussed, but the Chinese have been taking important steps into Africa in recent years, and now they're doing so in the Middle East in a bigger way than ever via Iran. Now remember what also happened regarding Iran. Remember I mentioned about Iran and the agreement on their nuclear power program being, it was actually cancelled. I don't know whether I actually mentioned that to you, but in fact it's been revived. It says the agreement is close on an atom deal with Iran. And it is the European, it says Iran appears yesterday to have reached a tentative deal with Britain, France and Germany that would avert the threat of United Nations sanctions on its nuclear program. And that was from the Daily Telegraph last Monday. So that is still on the boil there. But in this article from the Middle East org, it says the world stage is becoming far more complicated, far more quickly than generally appreciated. With an economy expanding an amazing 9% yearly, and in fact with considerable and growing leverage over the Americans economically and financially that is not usually discussed, China is positioning itself for the future. And Iran, seriously now threatened by the US-Israel alliance, is working with China as well as with Europe to outflank the Americans and in the short term to buy itself more crucial time to strengthen and to have at least a credible deterrent. With the US and Israel determined to keep all combinations of regional power from threatening their imperial dominance in the Middle East, the new involvements of both China and the Europeans are major developments sure to greatly affect the years ahead. Now what is actually happening, and really I've only got time to read this one piece, it says that, this is from the Asia Times of the 6th of November, that's last week. It says, a mere 2 months ago, the news of a China-Kazakhstan pipeline agreement worth $3.5 billion raised some eyebrows in the world press, some hinting that China's economic foreign policy may be on the verge of a new leap forward. A clue to the fact that such anticipation may have been totally understated, the case was last week's signing of a mega-gas deal between Beijing and Tehran worth $100 billion. So not $3.5 billion, but $100 billion. That's a phenomenal jump. Billed as the deal of the century by various commentators, this agreement is likely to increase by another 50 to 100 billion, bringing the total close to $200 billion. $200,000 million, when a similar oil agreement currently being negotiated is linked not too far from now. And what in fact is happening is they're wanting the natural gas. Now when you see what in fact China is having to put up with at the moment, when you put it together with that article that's coming from this gifts industry and how in fact they're having to curtail production, you can see how important it is to China to have this agreement in the Middle East. Now, it is interesting that when at the same time as we were discussing all these kind of bits and pieces, I happened to be talking to a born-again Christian just this last week, and this particular chap said to me, he said, he was talking about the Middle East, he said, you know, who is it that really has the authority to be in the Middle East, in that area anyway? He's looking at Arafat and he's looking at Israel. And I thought, shall I or shan't I? But really, this guy would never have got what I had to say. And he was literally going, walking out the door. He had to get out and go somewhere. He just popped in just very briefly. But you know, when you think about it, just turn over to Genesis 12. Genesis 12. I'm going to have to go on a little bit longer, and we'll probably just have to go on a little bit over time. But in Genesis chapter 12, just let's remind ourselves of this. In verse 6, it says, "And Abraham passed through the land to the place of Shechem, into the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Eternal appeared to Abram and said, unto your seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar to the Eternal who appeared to him." The trouble is, both the Arabs and the Jews are also, both of them, coming from Abraham. So they both lay claim to the land. Well, when you turn over to Genesis 48, if you go over to Genesis 48, I'm sorry to rush through this, but we don't really have much time. "And Jacob said to Joseph," now here's Joseph, and here's Joseph with Ephraim and Manasseh, and it says, "Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me, and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you." Sorry, this is Genesis 48, verse 3 and verse 4 now. I'll make you fruitful and multiply you, and will make of you a multitude of peoples, and I will give this land to your seed after you for an everlasting possession." Now there is Israel. But notice, it's not just Israel. It's not just the Jews. It says, "And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine." Now we might look at that and we might think, okay, then it's clear it's got to be the Jews initially, when you first of all think about it as far as these people are Israel. Israel has been talking about, or Britain and America, or Israel generally. But there's more to it than that. Turn over to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3. You see, the real one who has the right to that land isn't here yet. The real ones. Galatians chapter 3, verse 26, it says, "For you are all the children of God by faith in Jesus Christ. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There's neither Jew nor Greek, there's bond nor free, male nor female, for you all in one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ's, then are you Abraham's seed, and heirs according to the promise." So it is the church. And I won't actually turn there, but Daniel 7 talks about how the kingdom was given to the saints of the Most High. It talks about in the days of these kings over in Daniel 2, that the days of these kings will the God of heaven set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And the first location, the geographical location, will be this area, will be Palestine, will be Jerusalem, will be all around that area from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates. A vast area in that sense, but that will be the beginning of the kingdom of God. So when we see these things emerging within the Middle East, when we see the confrontation that there is and how all the major players on the earth at the moment are centered on this particular area, we need to understand whose right it is. It is Shiloh. It is the one whose right it is. And when he returns, he will give it to the saints, and we will administer that area. That area will be the beginning of the very kingdom of God. And it's interesting that Satan is stirring up the various nations at the moment, and he knows what in fact is going to happen in the future. But everything seems to revolve around this area of the Middle East, and we shouldn't be surprised, but we certainly should watch, and we should realize that the boundaries of the interest are not merely in the Middle East itself. Europe has got its eyes down there, America certainly has, as you know, but so has China. And that is a very important aspect when you consider the final battles that will take place over this monumental area of the Middle East.